Why Angus King wants to be the next senator from Maine. Former Maine Governor Angus King came out of the blocks as the perceived frontrunner in the six-way race to replace retiring Republican Olympia Snowe. But King, who's running as an independent, has come under fire from both sides of the political spectrum. I'm Keith Shortall. We continue our series of Your Vote 2012 candidate interviews today with Angus King. Join the conversation, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. Angus King, independent for U.S. Senate. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Your Vote 2012 Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by AARP Maine, working to protect Social Security and Medicare. More information online at aarp.org/me. By Lambert Coffin, celebrating 25 years of delivering strategic legal counsel on issues and opportunities in Maine, with offices in Portland and Blue Hill. And by Garand Marketing and Communications, serving clients here and abroad from offices in Portland, Maine, the happiest people in business, Garand.com.
And Angus King, welcome to Maine Calling.
Keith, nice to be here. Nice to see you on a beautiful day in Bangor, Maine.
I know. We're here to talk about the issues today. We've got about 45 minutes. There's a lot to talk about. We're not here to talk about all the ads. But that said, I want to get out of the blocks here with a few questions about some of the claims made in these ads that are all over the television and give people a chance to hear your response to some of that.
Sure.
First of all, one of the ads, I think, basically suggests that you made millions in profits from in your wind business from federal loan guarantees and a federal grant. Those subsidies did happen, but you say you did not make millions. Can you explain?
Well, I can categorically answer that because the numbers are out there in income tax returns and financial filings. After 5 years in the wind business and hard work on two major projects, I ended up with a net of about $200,000. And that ad that says millions is just made up.
Still in the energy topic here. This is not an ad, but it was raised in a blog, I believe, that said that you've been a wind advocate for these past few years, but since becoming a paid board member of the engineering consulting firm Woodard & Curran, you suddenly caught on to natural gas. That became your you became a cheerleader for natural gas, and they're trying to make a connection that your relationship as a paid board member somehow prompted you to become this cheerleader.
Well, these guys seem to be trying to make connections on everything. It's complete nonsense. I continue to learn and work on issues all the time and had a series of briefings last summer and over the course of the last year. Natural gas is a huge opportunity for this country. It doesn't mean I've abandoned my support for renewables. I've always said renewables are never going to, not now anyway, going to be the whole answer. At some point they may be as the technology improves, but natural gas I see as a transition fuel. If hydrofracking is done carefully and is regulated properly, I'm satisfied it can be done safely, and the environmental benefits are enormous if we can use natural gas to get off of oil and coal. So I think there are tremendous advantages, and the price is what's driven electricity rates down in Maine, and it's a huge advantage for us. So, you know, I was so shocked when Charlie Summers raised that at a debate in Lewiston last week. It never had crossed my mind. I called the president of Woodard & Curran, which is a Maine company, a great Maine company, and I'm a little disappointed these guys will just drag anybody through the mud on this stuff. 2% of their revenues are attributable to oil and gas work. It's an environmental engineering firm, and I joined the board because I was invited to. I was honored to be invited, and they're really, really good people doing great work. And the idea that somehow, you know, this gave me a financial interest in oil and gas is just it's just nonsense. And it says something about, you know, the level of politics these days.
The one ad that came out very early, which was the king of big spending.
Yeah, my granddaughter loved that ad because it showed me with a crown on. She thought that was really cool.
But it's painted you as a as a big spender during your time as governor of Maine, that you raised taxes and that you left a deficit. Yeah. Is there no kernel of truth in any of that?
Well, it depends. I guess it's a kernel of truth, you know, a tiny grain of sand of truth, perhaps. Actually, I went back and looked at the record just last week because I saw that ad, raise taxes. We actually cut taxes 18 times. 18 different taxes were cut. And the net, and it's true, I proposed an increase in the gas tax because we weren't able to pay for our roads, and there was a increase in the meals and lodging tax. But overall, the net decrease in taxes during my administration was over $400 million a year. In everything from the hospital tax to the property tax to the income tax to all kinds of different taxes were lowered, as I say, 18 times. So that's not true. This idea of a deficit is just bunk, and they keep saying it, and it's just not true. There is the Maine state budget process starts with something called a structural gap analysis, which is where you project out the revenues and then you project out expenditures. Based on current laws, you're going to buy everything, it's sort of the wish list budget, it creates something called a structural gap. In 10 of the last 11 budgets, going back to Jock McKernan, Angus King, John Baldacci, and Paul LePage, there have been structural gaps. There's only been one time it ever showed a positive, and that was when I was governor, as a matter of fact. So this idea that somehow I left a deficit, I mean, we just learned last week that Paul LePage faces a structural gap of $755 million, and I don't think anybody's accusing him of being profligate. It's a misunderstanding of how our system works, which isn't surprising because these ads are being made in Washington by guys that don't know anything about Maine.
As we said at the top, you've been criticized from folks on both sides of the spectrum, painted on the one hand as a big business-loving one percenter, and then by the Karl Rove ads as a secret liberal Democrat.
Yeah, that tells me maybe I'm getting it right. If you're getting hammered from both sides, you know, maybe you're where you're supposed to be, which is in the middle. And I call them as I see them, and try to make the best decisions for Maine and for the country based on the facts and not ideology and not what a party tells me. I mean, the big issue in this campaign is that this country is being killed by partisanship. We can't get anything done. On the news just before we went on the air, they talked about the impact of no farm bill. I mean, it's ridiculous. They can't pass a farm bill. And, you know, this Congress is doing absolutely nothing. And John McCain said it's the worst Congress in history. Olympia Snowe left because the Congress isn't doing anything. So, you know, that's really what we need to be talking about. And that's why I'm running. That's why I'm running as an independent.
You had a previous career as the host of a program called Maine Watch that's right. Still on our air years ago. You grilled a few candidates at that time. Would you, if you were back there then, would you be grilling yourself on some of these issues that have been raised?
Sure. And you know, it's interesting because I hadn't thought about it at the time until after I became governor. I realized that Maine Watch was actually pretty good training for reasons that I hadn't thought of. Asking questions is a key element of leadership, because you're constantly trying to gain information. And if you don't ask questions, you don't get the information if you don't probe. So as I look back on that, I realize that my efforts to probe and prod politicians and public figures to get information was actually an important part of what turned out to be how I end up making decisions and trying to get at the facts and the data. Sure, if I was sitting in your shoes, I'd be asking just the questions you're asking. And I'm delighted to answer them, frankly, because these ads are just, you know, I'm waiting for him to say, you know, he killed his grandmother. I mean, they're just making stuff up. But one of the ads now says I slashed education spending, which is just utterly ridiculous. I can't figure out where that comes from. And there's no accountability, Keith. That's what's really the problem. These third-party ads, Karl Rove, there's no, you know, Mr. Summers is the beneficiary, but he doesn't have to stand up and say, I approve this message. And there's no accountability, and they just make stuff up or take, you know, a little grain of something and turn it into this, you know, they take things I say out of context. One of the ads had a sentence that I said about people don't want to talk about about health care and the economy. And they cut it off, and they said, this is what King said. How can he say that? Well, what I actually said was, when people come up to me on the street, which is true, they don't start out talking about health care or the economy. They start out talking about how messed up Congress is. That's what's on people's minds. That's what I'm hearing on the street in Maine, that the Congress just isn't working. And so that's And that's an example of how these ads are. It's pretty awful.
We'll hear what's on the minds of some of our listeners in a few moments. Again, to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We're getting a lot of response, and we'll go to that in a minute. But let's start with some of the issues. The economy, which started out as the major issue in this campaign. What can a senator do? What would you do, if anything, to create jobs and improve the economy?
Well, the first thing you have to do is try to make the Senate work. I mean, a perfect example is about 2 weeks ago, there was a bill in the Senate, before the Senate, to help with the employment of veterans. 20,000 jobs, $1 billion price tag, but the price tag was funded. They'd found cuts in other places. It was fully funded, and the bill failed. It got 58 votes to 40, and it failed because of a Republican-led filibuster. Blessedly, our two senators both voted for it. But that's the kind of thing. I mean, we can't do anything to help the economy if the institution itself is so broken that it can't pass a fairly straightforward bill that would have put 20,000 veterans to work. I think that's terrible. So there's a whole host of things, and I just issued a little booklet called We Lead that stands for a series of steps that I think we need to do for the economy. There's no single thing. We've got to do a lot of things.
Can you list a few?
Well, a smarter trade policy, for example. We're going to lose 900 jobs in Maine if they lift the tariff on athletic footwear, and our company's New Balance is expected to compete with companies in Vietnam that don't have to meet any of the environmental or labor standards we have here. I just think that's ridiculous. So trade policy, better coordination of training. There's something like 55 different federal job training programs in 9 different agencies. That doesn't make any sense. That's both expensive, and I don't think it's very effective. So that's got to be part of it. Education policy is part of it. Certainly taxes is part of the problem. And I think one of the biggest problems that I've encountered as I've been campaigning, and I certainly had encountered it as a citizen, is overregulation. And this is where the Democrats get mad at me and say, you know, you're really a Republican. But the regulations that we're applying in a whole host of areas are just, they're onerous, they're duplicative. The federal agencies don't talk to each other. And one day, a week or so ago, I had 4 different people raise issues of regulations in areas as diverse as fisheries, housing, and finance. And it really is a drag on the economy, and I think that's one of the areas where we have to really do some work.
One of the answers from candidates is on this question is to, well, we need to fix the national debt, the deficit, fix this gap, and that will help the economy. Is there a connection there?
Well, I think there is, because I think the uncertainty created by the national debt, which is a enormously serious problem that we really do have to do something about. The uncertainty created by that situation is itself a drag on the economy. I think it's keeping businesses from investing and hiring. I think it's like a cloud on the horizon. And now we've got this, what they call the fiscal cliff, with the sequestration, the expiration of the tax cuts, and the debt limit all coming at the same time. It's the most predictable and avoidable financial crisis in history. But the question is Congress going to be able to get itself together to avoid it? I ran across a great idea that I'm certainly going to pursue in Washington. It's very straightforward and simple. No budget, no pay. The basic function of Congress is to pass a budget. They haven't passed a budget in 3 years, and I know of few jobs where you can go down, work 3 days a week, not accomplish what you're supposed to accomplish, and you still get paid. And there's a bill making the rounds in Washington called No Budget, No Pay, and I just think that's a heck of a good idea.
What two big things would you do to close that debt? You have two options. Three options. One's grow the economy. One is cut spending, and one is increase taxes.
Well, I've done a fair amount of work on this and looked at a whole series of different solutions, the Ryan budget, the Simpson-Bowles, Domenici-Rivlin. There are all these plans. Simpson-Bowles is, I think, the most realistic and thoughtful. It's bipartisan. Alan Simpson's a Republican former senator from Wyoming, and Erskine Bowles used to work for Bill Clinton. It's got something for everyone to hate. and there are provisions in it that I don't like that I think actually shouldn't go. One is a significant gas tax increase to fund an infrastructure fund. I think at this moment in time with gas prices where they are, that doesn't make much sense. That's not really part of the deficit reduction. But the rest of it is it basically what it does is it's $2 of spending cuts for every dollar of revenue increases, and the revenue increases are eliminating deductions and exemptions and lowering rates. And for every dollar of increased revenues, 92 cents would go to lower rates. So instead of 35, it would be 28, or instead of 25, it would be 18. So tax rates would go down on everyone. And then 8 cents of that dollar would go to deficit reduction. One of the issues in the campaign, Keith, is that Mr. Summers has signed the Grover Norquist No Taxes Ever pledge, which would affect he couldn't support Simpson Bowles. He couldn't support anything like Simpson Bowles because they hold that anything that increases federal revenues by a dime is a violation of the pledge. And I just think realistically, to solve this problem, that you can't be serious about it if you've taken that pledge. And I don't think you should take a pledge to some guy in Washington who's never run for anything, who's never run anything. Instead of my pledge is to the people of Maine to do what's right by them.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions for Angus King, independent for U.S. Senate. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
MPBN will soon host the first of three debates leading up to the November 6 election. U.S. Representative Shelley Pingree and State Senator John Courtney will each make their case to voters in Maine's 1st Congressional District. If you have a question for the candidates, submit it at mpbn.net/yourvote or on MPBN's Facebook page. And join us for the Your Vote 2012 1st District Congressional District Debate on radio, television, and online at mpbn.net.
Join us for this live broadcast Thursday evening at 8 on MPBN Radio and Television.
Hi, Charles Beck here, Director of Radio at MPBN. This service plays a very important role in the lives of many in our community, connecting everybody every day to what's going on in our state, around the country, and around the world. We live in complicated times, and having a source for news and information that is comprehensive, in-depth, independent, and trusted is a valued public service that we know many of you count on now more than ever. This is listener-supported MPBN Radio.
Broadcast of this Your Vote 2012 Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by AARP Maine, working to protect Social Security and Medicare. More information online at aarp.org/me. By Lambert Coffin, celebrating 25 years of delivering strategic legal counsel on issues and opportunities in Maine, with offices in Portland and Blue Hill. And by Garand Marketing and Communications, serving clients here and abroad from offices in Portland, Maine, the happiest people in business, Garand.com.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, a Your Vote 2012 interview with Angus King. He's an independent candidate for Senate, the Senate seat being vacated by the retiring Olympia Snow. We'd like you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Let's go to the phones now to Gorham and Jackie. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Governor, let's go ahead.
King.
Hi, Jackie.
President Obama wishes to raise taxes on those earning more than $250,000 a year, and Governor Romney does not. What is your position on this issue?
Well, originally I was in favor of raising those taxes, but when we started getting those very weak job reports of $68,000 and $70,000 a month, I developed a slightly different position, which is I do think those tax cuts should expire at some point, but not until the economy is clearly back on its feet, and therefore the expiration should be triggered not by an arbitrary date as it is now, January 1st or April 12th or March 1st, but by something out there in the economy, 3.2% economy growth or unemployment below 6%. And I articulated, I stated this position a couple of months ago, and interestingly, to my surprise somewhat, the national press picked it up and said this is one of the best ideas to come out of this campaign for the whole country. And the idea is to have the economy determine these things rather than these votes in Congress where it becomes a war and posturing and deadlines and all that kind of thing. We did this in Maine back. Governor McKernan passed a temporary increase in the sales tax up to 6%, and it automatically dropped during my administration when the state revenues increased by more than 8% a year. And there was no vote on it. There was no struggle. There was no politics. It just happened. And I think that's a much better way to handle this.
I see. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie.
Jackie, thanks for joining us today. We have a note from Greg in Troy who says, Governor King, Wall Street speculation is at the root of much of the current economic hardship and deficit, and the high-rolling banks also were great beneficiaries of the federal bailout. Would you support a tax on stock transactions and derivative trades to partially recoup the net cost of the TARP?
I'm not sure I would support that. I'd have to see what the economic effect would be and what the income would be, whether it would be significant or whether it would be a drag on the economy. What I would support, and I mentioned earlier when Keith and I were talking about regulation, I'm not a big fan of the so-called Dodd-Frank bill. I would instead vote for and support a restoration of something called the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the law from the 30s into the late 90s that kept commercial banks and investment banks separate. And I think one of the great mistakes, and it was a bipartisan mistake made in the late 90s, was to abolish the Glass-Steagall Act. And I think that would be the most effective thing to protect us from the kind of financial manipulation and downfall that hit us in 2008. I'm just not convinced that a financial transaction tax, I'd want to understand better who it would actually apply to. It's easy to say it would apply to Wall Street traders, but if it would apply to individuals in Maine that buy and sell stock or financial instruments, I'm not sure it would be a positive.
We know you support natural gas. We know you support wind. On the energy front, what about increased domestic oil drilling?
Well, it depends on where it is. I'm not categorically. I try not to take these positions, Keith, on an ideology. No drilling ever anywhere, or drill, baby, drill. I think it depends on the circumstances. I think that from talking to Bob Marvini, who was on the radio a few minutes ago, who's the state geologist, I don't think there's much in the way of oil out on the Georgia's banks or out offshore of Maine, and I think the risks far outweigh the benefits. It wouldn't be that much oil. It wouldn't provide us much in the way of a supply. I really think the imperative on energy is to get off of oil. And natural gas gives us an opportunity to do that. And the quicker we can move toward that and renewables, and I see natural gas as a kind of transition fuel, I think the better off we are. If oil exploration, for example, I'm opposed to drilling in Anwar, the National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. There just isn't. There's something like 90 days of worldwide supply, and it's in 26 or 27 different places. I just think the impact versus the benefit isn't that great. And that's an example of how I make decisions. I try to start out with the facts and the science, and I think that's really important because now we're in this system where if the party says, we're for Anwar, then that's the way you go. And if the party says we're against it, that's the way you go. And I try to call them as I see them based on the actual data.
Let's go to China and Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi, this is Bob, and I really love, Governor King, I really love your support of all of the alternative energy ideas, but one of the ones, and you've spoken about natural gas, but I'm concerned about the LPG gas tank, the humongous tank they want to build in Searsport, and I'm wondering if you're willing to take a stand against that tank as not a solution for Penobscot Bay and for all of the reasons that I could go on and on about, but I'd just like to get your position. I wonder if you're up on that issue.
Well, the latter is important. I don't know the details. I do know that Maine, it's a propane tank, as I understand it. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Propane is not natural gas, and we're trying to put natural gas lines into Maine anyway.
Right.
Propane doesn't make sense, and especially a tank of that size and magnitude for that for this area?
Well, they're propane is heavily used. I mean, there are a lot of places in Maine that aren't going to ever get a pipeline, and propane is their alternative, and it's a big part of Maine, and those trucks are now coming in from other places. I think this is a local decision, and my understanding is that there was a referendum, or there've been a couple of local votes, local planning board, I believe in local control and those kinds of things. I don't know. I mean, I think it really is up to the people of Searsport to decide whether the economic benefit to them outweighs the whatever the costs are. So I'm not gonna jump in on one side of that or the other, because I think it's up to the folks in the town.
I want to move along to healthcare, but finally on energy, nuclear power. We had an earthquake last night in Maine. Yeah. Are you at all concerned about the future safety, economically or environmentally?
Well, nuclear power is unbelievably expensive, and I just think, given what we saw in Japan, but really the issue is cost. I mean, there's a nuclear power plant proposed in Georgia. I understand it's gotten an $8.3 billion federal guarantee, and they're still not necessarily going forward with it. I remember Seabrook 2 in the 80s, where the avoided cost was 12, 14 cents a kilowatt hour, very high. I just don't think nuclear power is feasible economically from as it stands now, not to mention the risks. And, you know, I had to deal with the closure of Maine Yankee, and we're still stuck with high-level nuclear waste sitting there in Wiscasset because the federal government has never gotten its act together to create a central waste repository. And it just bothers me to generate power and generate waste at the same time that our generation isn't taken care of and we're expecting our kids and grandchildren to deal with. So I'm not a big fan of nuclear power.
To healthcare, do you support the president's Affordable Care Act?
Yes, I do. And I would have voted for it, and I would vote against repealing it. It is already benefiting people in Maine. I got a letter just 3 days ago from a guy here in Bangor who was born with a brain tumor, not cancerous, fortunately, but it's there. And he's 23 years old. He's trying to find a full-time job. The Affordable Care Act has allowed him to stay on his parents' insurance until he's 26. That's a big deal. And secondly, his brain tumor is not now considered a pre-existing condition that'll keep him from getting health insurance. That's a very practical, real benefit to people in Maine. There are no lifetime limits anymore. So even though the law isn't fully implemented, there are people in Maine who are clearly benefiting from it. And, you know, people keep saying we want to repeal, and the first thing I would do is repeal Obamacare and all that kind of thing. But they never tell you what they would replace it with. And I've never heard a credible alternative. And I think it's shameful in this country that we have between 30 and 50 million people without insurance. And there's no question that it affects their ability to have health care. And I don't want to drag this out, but I'm powerfully influenced by my own experience.
Medicare.
And I just think it would be a real step backward to repeal that law.
Futurists will say that Medicare and Social Security demand action now to prevent a crisis, if a crisis isn't already looming. How do you assess the problems with those two benefits, and what should we do about them?
It's really important to distinguish between the two. It is not true that Social Security is in a crisis. The changes that were made in Social Security back in 1986 anticipated the baby boomers' retirements. It anticipated the demands that would be placed on the system in this century. And fixing Social Security to be actuarially sound for the next 75 years is not a huge issue. It's fairly straightforward. One thing is now the Social Security tax stops when you get to $110,000 of income. You don't pay it at all. That needs to be increased, and that would go a long way toward solving the issue. And it may be that 30 years from now, the retirement age would have to be gradually moved out a year or two.
Means
depending on the circumstances. I'm not in favor of means testing. The best answer I ever encountered on that was from George Mitchell. I once asked him that question. Why don't we means test Social Security, and why should wealthy people get it? His answer was, if you means test it, it becomes a welfare program. And it really needs to be a social insurance program that everybody participates in. Otherwise, the political support for it starts to diminish.
Got about a minute left. Medicare?
Medicare is a much bigger problem. That's a problem right now. I think we have to fundamentally talk about a different way of paying for health care and turn it from paying fee for service for procedures and turn it around to paying for health. We need to reward preventive care and primary care. And in fact, there are two or three proposals happening right now in Maine under the Affordable Care Act in southern Maine and up here in eastern Maine in Bangor, where it's called an accountable care organization, where the payments are made under Medicare for keeping people healthy rather than treating them when they're sick. And I think that's the direction we have to go in. We've got to cut the cost of medical care. It's twice as high per person in the U.S. than it is virtually anywhere else in the world. And so we got to start figuring out structurally how to do it differently.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions for Angus King, independent for U.S. Senate. Please stay with us.
Tomorrow evening, MPBN will host and broadcast a live Your Vote 2012 debate among the candidates for Maine's 1st District congressional seat. The debate is being held in Studzinski Recital Hall at Bowdoin College in Brunswick. Seating is open to the public on a first-come, first-served basis. Seating is limited. If you'd like more information, please call 207-725-3433 or visit our website, mpbn.net. Again, MPBN's Your Vote 2012 First District Congressional Debate this Thursday evening in Brunswick in the Studzinski Recital Hall at Bowdoin College. Audience should be seated no later than 7:45. Please feel free to join us or make sure to tune in to both MPBN radio and television. MPBN's Your Vote 2012, providing you with comprehensive and trusted election information. Also, as part of that Your Vote 2012 election coverage, MPBN Radio will be repeating last night's presidential debate from New York this afternoon from 1 till 3. Diane Rehm will be heard an hour later than normal at 3 o'clock and offer a follow-up and analysis of the debate. The world will not be heard today. If you'd like to watch the debate, MPBN Television will repeat the debate in its entirety this Sunday afternoon at 2:30. Again, MPBN Radio, the debate can be heard this afternoon at 1, immediately following Maine Calling, as part of MPBN's Your Vote 2012 election coverage.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2012 conversation with Angus King, independent candidate for U.S. Senate. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. Let's go to Old Town and Rosemary. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I have a question for Governor King. Do you really, really think one person can make a difference in Washington?
Rosemary, that's a great question, and that's the question that I wrestled with when deciding to do this. Somebody's got to try. I don't think you just give up if you say, man, it's not working, and you put your finger on it. We've been talking about issues like the economy, health care, debt, Social Security, but we can't get to any of those issues if the Congress is just so broken and locked up. That's why Olympia Snow left, and that's why I decided to run. Can one person make a difference? I think only one person can make a difference. You gotta start somewhere, and it could be they're now predicting that the U.S. Senate could end up 50-49-1, and if I'm the one, I think any question about whether or not I can make a difference has been pretty clearly resolved. But U.S. Senate, there are only 100 votes. And I think every vote is important. And I remember our great Senator Margaret Chase Smith. She never told people how she was going to vote. She was a Republican, but she was very independent. Her vote was unsure up to the last minute, and it made her very important and very influential, and gave her a chance to really make a difference. So. If I didn't think it was something that I could make a difference, I wouldn't be doing this. There are a lot easier ways to be spending this fall. I can assure you of that.
Here's where we're getting some tweets and Facebook messages about this "with whom will you caucus" question.
Sure.
And it keeps coming up, and yet you seem reluctant to answer that. Can you just address that for us?
I'm not reluctant. It's really a question that I can answer. Number one, I'm an independent. My goal is to be as independent as I can be, as long as I can be. And the more independent I can be, the more influential I can be. On the other hand, I may have to caucus or join one of the other teams, at least for the purposes of organizing the Senate, in order to have an important committee assignment. And I'm not doing this as a stunt. I need to be on a committee. That's where a lot of the work is done, and I want to be effective on behalf of Maine. It's impossible to answer that question. because I don't know what the proposals will be. I don't know what the requirements will be. It may be that one party, for example, says, vote with us once to organize the Senate, and then you're on your own. We'll give you a good committee assignment. You're independent. You can be as independent as you want to be. The other party may say, well, you got to vote for us 85% of the time, or we'll kick you off your committee. And those are the kinds of things that it's impossible to resolve right now. Plus, if I said now I'm going to caucus with the Republicans, I'm going to caucus with the Democrats, I'm basically giving up my bargaining power. When you walk in to buy a car, you don't say, I'm willing to pay $20,000, but I'm going to start off with an offer of $16,000. I mean, if there's some doubt about where you'll go, then you have an opportunity to negotiate on behalf of Maine. That's really what this is all about.
So you're not waiting for the results of the makeup of the Senate?
Well, that may influence what's on the table. And as I say, if it's 50 to 49 to 1, I'll be in a very influential position. And it just there are too many considerations for me that they're unknowable at this point. And I have purposefully not talked to anybody. I mean, I know the Republicans assumed from the first day that I was going to caucus with the Democrats, but I haven't been in touch with anybody down there, and I haven't had any communication with any of the, you know, the Democratic leadership or the staff. The whole reason I'm doing this is that Congress is really broken, and if we don't do something about that, we never get to any of these other important issues we've been talking about.
Another important issue, which isn't getting a lot of attention in this race, is foreign policy. What should be the U.S. position with respect to Iran and its nuclear program, and how aggressive should we be in stopping them if they are developing it?
Well, we had a debate on foreign policy in Camden the other night, and that's one of the really I think it's the central and most difficult issue facing American foreign policy right now. It would be a disaster for America. Forget about Israel for a minute, not just Israel, not just the Middle East, for America, if Iran became a nuclear power. They are already one of the leading countries in the world in terms of exporting terrorism. And for them to develop a nuclear capability, which then could be exported in a small package to New York Harbor or anywhere else in the world, would be a disaster. So the sanctions have to be the strongest ever applied in the world. Normally, sanctions don't work. In this case, they really seem to be working. They are the most severe sanctions ever applied to a country in the world. Last month, I understand the economy of Iran contracted. They had inflation of 69%. The middle class in Iran is starting to violently protest in Tehran, and it may well have it looks like it may well have the desired effect. But the Iranians also have to believe that there's a credible threat of military action. Not that that's anything we want to do, and there are lots of reasons to not do it. But if they're not at least a little worried about it, then it's going to be hard to move them off the path that they're on. I think it's critical that we do that.
Do you agree with the president's plan for withdrawal from Afghanistan?
Yes, and it's probably should have been done sooner. That's the longest war in American history. It's not clear exactly what the goal was. We certainly didn't have a plan for getting out when we went in. If there's any lesson from the last decade, it's we don't commit military action without. Number one, it should be clearly in the national interest. Number two, we should understand what the costs and benefits are going to be. And number three, we should know how we're going to get out. And Iraq and Afghanistan don't meet those standards.
Let's go to Dick in Corinth. Hi, Dick.
Hey, hi, Governor King. I just wondered, of all the issues which you face, I wonder which one you see as your most difficult, greatest challenge in Washington.
I think the national debt is the greatest challenge. I don't think people fully realize, and you know, I don't think I did until I've really been working on it in the last year or so, how serious it is. 36 to 40 cents of every dollar we spend in Washington is borrowed. And we're borrowing it from our kids. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the tax cuts and those kinds of things. When we cut taxes and don't cut spending, which is what's happened over the last decade, it's not really a tax cut. It's really just shifting the tax to our kids because they're going to have to pay for it because we're building up this bill. And I just think it's wrong. And yet the problem is so serious now that There's no easy way out of it. It's not people who say, well, we're going to root out fraud, waste, and abuse, or we're going to grow our way out of it. I mean, that's really not a serious. They're not facing it. And I really think that's the toughest problem that we face. And I think it affects the economy. It affects the future. I think it affects how people feel about where we're going. I mean, just to – I don't want to depress you, but if you project out the current course that we're on, we're Greece in 20 years. We're at the same place they are in terms of the relation of debt to their economy. And that's just not a place we want to be. And there's no simple, easy, painless way out, and we've got to do something about it. I think that's the toughest issue that I've encountered.
About 2 minutes left. Let's go to South Portland and Susan. Hi, Susan. Welcome to Bain Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Governor King, I was wondering, I've seen you started off the campaign by saying you wouldn't engage in negative campaigning, right. And now I'm seeing television ads with you kind of dimly lit, and they're saying that you are engaging in negative advertising, and I'm kind of confused. Could you clear that up, please?
Yeah. What I consider negative ads are those ones that you see that, you know, that have me in a caricature and a dark voice that says King slashed education spending and kicks dogs and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I made one ad where I look at the camera myself and say, here are three major differences between me and Charlie Summers. He has signed Grover Norquist's no tax pledge, which makes it impossible to resolve the debt problem. He doesn't believe that humans are contributing significantly to global warming, and he believes in tax subsidies to big oil. And I say, I don't agree with those things. Now, I don't think that's negative campaigning. I think that's just stating what the differences are on policy as opposed to these 30-second ads. And the other thing is, I think a shorthand way to answer your confusion is, if somebody looks at the camera and says, I approve of this ad, that's them taking accountability. The really one of the bad things about this system now is that these ads, this guy Karl Rove, you know, wherever he is, Texas or Washington, is now spending $300,000 or $400,000 in Maine attacking me, and nobody's accountable for those ads. He can say whatever he wants. I mean, and there's apparently an ad up today that says I slashed education spending. I mean, that's really puzzling.
But 30
I have
seconds,
no idea where that came from.
About 30 seconds left. Would you take action in the Senate to change to? Sort of offset the effects of Citizens United?
Yes. I think, number one, there should be a constitutional amendment if possible. I think it's going to be very difficult to reverse that decision, which is the worst decision in 100 years from the Supreme Court as far as I'm concerned. But in the short run, one thing the Senate could do tomorrow is require disclosure of the people who are giving this money. All of this money that's coming in for these negative ads against me, we don't know where it's coming from. You know, it could be coming from Vladimir Putin, for all I know, or coming from the oil companies or pharmaceuticals or whoever. And I think it would be very helpful to the people of Maine if they knew who was paying for the ads that are trying to influence their votes. And that's something the Congress could do. The Supreme Court left that open, and the Senate was unable to take that action because of a filibuster, which I think is ridiculous.
Angus King, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Keith, a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Angus King, running as an independent candidate for U.S. Senate. That concludes our series of Your Vote 2012 candidate interviews. We've talked with all the candidates on the ballot, the federal ballot, except for Congressman Mike Mishu, who has decided not to take part in this series. The Your Vote 2012 interviews can be found on the MPBN website. Go to mpbn.net and click on the Your Vote 2012 banner. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. Matthew Schreiber ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team and John Keimel. Tomorrow on the program, Reinventing Retirement. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.
Broadcast.